the end of every interview that we have for teacher candidates, we will say, "What questions do you have for us?" And they will always ask, "Well, what kind of support can I expect?" And we will always say, "Well, don't worry, we'll give you a mentor." But it's not real mentorship. I mean, it's support with the difficult kid or the field trip form or the grade card, but it isn't coaching. That's where partners like EdConnective step in. They provide observation and feedback with practice. That's real coaching. Their mission is to ensure that every student thrives by facilitating exceptional educator growth. So whether it's science of reading, whether it's leadership development, whether you're trying to build the best recruitment and retention efforts, check out edconnective.com. Hello, Imperfect Leaders. I'm actually in the great state of Wisconsin at the moment, working with a superintendent on systems thinking. And, well, the Brewers are not in town, which is disappointing, but I do get to spend some time with a terrific leader. We're going to look at habits of systems thinking. We're going to look at how a system's behavior is generated by its structure, which is something that took me, I think it was like my third year as a leader to really understand that when things happen, that you kind of have to like look at what's happening, the patterns over time, the structures that were created by those patterns, the beliefs, the principles, the values that are at the heart of that system. My guest today has looked at the system, and with his partner, they found a leverage point to make the system, the housing system specifically, work for everyone, not just for some. And you have to listen to this episode. You have to. My guest is Samir Goyal, and in part one, we talk about the company he co-founded, and in part two, we talk about what he has learned about giving feedback to employees. Imperfect Leaders, you're going to love this episode. I'm Peter Stiepelman, and this is an Imperfect Leader, the Superintendents and Leadership Podcast. Today on an Imperfect Leader, Samir Goyal is my guest. And Samir and his partner, Wemi Mo, is the co-founder and co-CEO of Isuzu, the leading financial technology company helping individuals save money and build credit. Now, what does that have to do with transformational educational leadership? Well, everything. Like every single aspiring new and experienced superintendent who tunes in every week to our podcast, An Imperfect Leader, Samir is committed to making sure the system works for everyone, not just some. Equity and justice are at the core of his past work experiences and certainly with Isuzu. So let's start with a proper welcome. Samir, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Peter, it's great to be here and thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased to have had the chance to meet you twice, actually, in the last 5 months. The last time was in your office, and I asked you about a nonprofit social venture that you co-founded about 10 years ago called Transfernation. And I was really interested in learning more about it because of what it did. It redistributed excess food to underserved communities. I want to talk about Isuzu because so many superintendents and district leaders are going to want to immediately learn how they can continue to help their families and their employees. But I wanted to ask about Transfernation because one of the things that schools have to navigate is food planning, food production, and at times, food waste. And so I wonder, would you tell us just a little bit about Transfernation?
Absolutely, Peter. So I'd say Transfernation was my first foray into social enterprise. And to your point, started the organization maybe a little over a decade ago with my co-founder, Hannah. And, you know, as you alluded to, was really sort of galvanized by just the amount of food waste that I saw. You know, I grew up in a family where I was taught to pick off every last crumb off the plate because we may not have enough or, you know people who don't have enough. And so that always really stuck with me and resonated. And when I was living in New York, I just saw every day I'd go to events, I'd go to functions, and I'd see more than half often of the food was thrown away. So that really galvanized us to do something about it. And the solution we came up with, Transfernation, we would basically work with large-scale events, so largely corporate events or corporate cafeterias, and we'd make sure that all the extra food at the end of the event or at the end of the cafe serving hours would be redistributed to shelters, soup kitchens, and other communities where access to healthy, quality, nutritious food wasn't available. And so a kind of layperson's way of thinking about what we built is really a logistics infrastructure like Uber without necessarily the same scale, but really figuring out how to get food that was perishable from point A to point B in the shortest amount of time possible. And the beauty of the model we created was it was also a benefit for the company or the corporation. It actually costs people money to throw food away. And so we were able to reduce their waste costs, give them a positive story to tell their sort of employees and other stakeholders. And at the same time, within that spread, we could create a margin for the nonprofit and actually earn revenue by helping companies manage their waste more efficiently.
You know, one of the things I asked you about it was, what about you know, we always hear the fact that, you know, food could spoil, right? And I think that that may be one of the limitations or obstacles that a school leader may think about in terms of redistributing or transferring food that could have been enjoyed by somebody else. And you told me about something that I hadn't even known about that actually came from the Clinton administration. I wonder, would you talk a little bit about federal law and protections for those who might actually sort of enter this and do something about food?
I'd be delighted to. You know, this was, even though it's been a decade, this was something I talked about literally every day for a few years. And so
welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. And in 1996, I think it was, President Bill Clinton at the time passed what's called the Good Samaritan Act. And that essentially created the standard of liability for the donation or gifting of food. And it was really centered around this concept of knowingly unfit for human consumption, which if you think about it, is a pretty lightweight liability clause, right? If something like a can of milk has been out for a couple of days, obviously it's spoiled and it's bad for human consumption. However, food that maybe was out for an event for a couple hours, or that's frankly most of the time been refrigerated the whole time and it's just being transported for 30 minutes, is not necessarily something that would run afoul of that standard, right? And I think, you know, maybe somewhere back in the history of time, there was some lawsuit around donated food, but frankly, I think it's almost more of a ghost story than a reality. And it's unfortunate because that misperception has really prevented a lot of people from giving away their excess food. But that's actually not what the federal statute or standards are, right? Knowingly unfit for human consumption is incredibly difficult to meet from a liability perspective unless you're just being negligent intentionally, right?
Yeah. And for those who are listening, one of the things I also asked Samir was thinking about, you know, the food that's being passed, is that what we're talking about in terms of packing that up and sending that out? And really what you helped me think about, because I was thinking of that and sort of comparing it to the food that's sort of sitting in the salad bar at a school. And you're not speaking to that food necessarily. You're speaking to all of the high quality, good food that is still packaged up, that's sitting in the back of the kitchen that otherwise would have just been thrown away.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same as with any corporate cafeteria, restaurant, or school as it is kind of across any of those other categories, right? Ultimately, you never want to run out of food. No school district can have a day where, you know, they run out of pizza or boxed lunches for kids, right? And there's 200 kids who just don't have a meal, right? So the natural instinct is to always overorder. So that way every kid has access to food. You have backups. Nobody can send kids home hungry in most school districts, right? And so as a result, there's a ton of food that never even leaves the shelf. It's kept perfectly refrigerated or perfectly heated. It sits there. And for whatever reason, people don't reuse it the next day. And so that food is just totally thrown away. So to be very clear, I'm not talking about like, you know, you give a kid a tray of food and they eat two bites of the pizza and then we go and donate it to someone. That is a walking recipe for disaster. Same with the corporate cafeteria. You have a salad bar.
That would fall in violation of the knowingly, right? You would knowingly.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only are kids sort of like walking germ factories, but also you would just want to do that in general. And so, you know, I think there's like a common sense principle here. And you know, obviously we live in a litigious society, but, you know, common sense can really govern how we think about some of these things.
In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension. It's called collective aspiration. And that really is like the heart of an organization's work. It sort of asks the question, what do we want to create together? And inside that dimension, there's another term. It's a strong moral focus. And Samir, your moral focus is totally clear. With Isuzu, you have this mission to dismantle barriers to housing for working families. You have a belief that housing is a fundamental right, and you envision a world without delinquency, without housing evictions, and without homelessness. And, you know, there's no stronger moral focus than that, Samir. So would you tell us a little bit about Isuzu, how it works, how individuals can begin earning credit for the simple act of paying their rent?
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate those kind words, and it means a lot coming from you. But by way of introduction on Isuzu, I always like to take a trip down memory lane and share a little bit about why myself and Wamimo started the organization. And for us, it really comes down to our personal experiences. For me, Peter, I grew up in an immigrant family from New Delhi, India. And when we moved to the United States of America, we thought we had made it. India's got well over a billion people. It's tough to make a living out there. And America obviously has tremendous opportunity. And unfortunately, we were met with a rather rude awakening when my father was mugged on his first day in the country, and we just didn't have much by way of shelter. And some of those experiences really set the tone for a lot of my early childhood, where I just watched my parents work miracles without a credit score and with limited financial resources, but still do everything they could possibly do to create that American dream, so to speak. And the thought I was left with was pretty simple. It shouldn't be so hard for people putting their best foot forward every day to have a fighting chance. And so inspired by that and my co-founder Wamimo's experiences immigrating from Nigeria, we founded Esusu on this simple premise that no matter where you come from, the color of your skin or your financial identity, it should never determine where you end up in life. And more practically, we found a very simple solution to help address this, which is leveraging rental payments to help people build and establish credit. For those who don't know, there's over 45 million Americans who are credit invisible, which means they can't access home loans, car loans, educational loans, even basic credit cards. Sometimes they're screened out of jobs. And so credit is truly your lifeline in this country. And we saw an opportunity to take your on-time rental payments and use that so that everyday folks have an opportunity to build and establish credit without getting into debt in the first place. We then built on that core product by adding in a program where if a renter falls behind on rent, we can pair them with the 0% interest loan that's sourced from philanthropic 501c3 organizations and paid directly to the landlord. Always, we're trying to create this win-win, right? If a renter has a financial emergency, we want to help them keep a roof over their head. But ultimately, a landlord has a business to run, and we want to make sure that they can also manage their cash flow. And so that's always how we think about creating those sort of win-win outcomes, both with rent reporting, rent relief, and the other products and services we offer our renters.
Let me ask you this. One of the things that I have learned in my work with public housing, so I've served as a commissioner in public housing in the community where I lived, and now I'm serving here in the community where I live now. And one of the pieces that is attractive when you think about things like Section 8 vouchers is that it's guaranteed payment, right? And so it sounds like what you're doing is having the opportunity to reward those who regularly pay their rent, right? Who may not be participating in public housing or Section 8 vouchers. And at the same time, should they fall behind, there's this safety net or this sort of support system that's in place to make sure that everybody is being paid, everybody is succeeding, and everybody gets to move forward. Am I capturing that kind of right?
You nailed it.
Yeah. So then it seems like those who are apartment owners who are renting out would only see this as a benefit. Every leader considers when they're making decisions about what proponents and opponents would say. And from every angle that I've been looking at this, there only seems to be a positive to being able to support those who previously would have been just, you talk about 45 million people, they would not have been able to access these type of benefits that are really accessible to everybody else.
Yeah, Peter, I think that's really well put. And something that we always try to be very intentional about is system design, right? And how do you create win-win-win outcomes? I think today in society, both in sort of business, but really just about every field you can think of, we love to kind of construct this us versus them, winner, loser sort of construct. And at Esusu, we always try to abolish that and really focus on how do we create a shared set of incentives. In real estate right now, there's really two defining narratives, both of which I think are a disservice. The first is the one that the landlord has sometimes, which is, hey, the renter is just trying to game the system, not pay rent, and is lazy, intentionally not working or whatever. And the reality is for most renters, right, life happens. It's tough to live in this country. The wage growth is not kept up with inflation. People have emergencies every day. I think the latest data is that less than 50% of American adults have more than $400 to cover a financial emergency, right? And so people's everyday struggle is very real. And so that narrative of just lazy renter is a disservice to many people who are trying their best. And on the flip side, there's this sort of narrative that every landlord is this sort of greedy corporate owner who kind of represents the man, so to speak, and is just trying to stomp down on everyday people. And frankly, running real estate is incredibly hard, right? It's a physical asset building. Things are breaking all the time. There's incredibly thin margins. You're dealing with climate. You're dealing with human health. You're dealing with turnover. And it's not an easy business at all. And frankly, it's incredibly regulated due to government sort of intervention in real estate. And so, you know, I think that narrative of the landlord just being this greedy kind of corporate owner is also a disservice to many landlords who are just trying to create a safe, quality place to live for their renters, right? And so instead, how do we come up with a system that allows landlords to successfully operate a business and allows renters the opportunity to navigate the very real sort of life events that happen? And so that's what we tried to do here, right? With rent reporting, people are encouraged to pay their rent on time. It's a positive incentive for people to pay rent, which means that landlords get paid on a timely basis and renters have the opportunity to improve their financial health. Same with the kind of rent relief or 0% interest loan program. Renters have a financial emergency. Rather than being evicted or homeless, they keep a roof over their head. And at the same time, landlords keep their cash flows healthy.
For those who are interested in learning a little bit more about Esusu, the website is pretty clear, right? Isuzu.com?
You got it.
Okay. And one of the things that I have learned when going to the website is just being able to see people's personal stories, because not only what you're describing is really, I mean, just revolutionary, to hear people talk about what a difference it has made in their lives, I would really recommend for those who are listening, for those who are school leaders who are thinking about how to support their families. I mean, so many of our districts have high percentages of free and reduced lunch, families trying to make ends meet, and are routinely having to change locations of where they live, which really is a disruption for their children and their education. To find out that there might be an option for them to be able to begin to build credit so that one day, sooner than they would have thought, they'll be able to provide for their families in a way that they never had conceived possible beforehand. So I really recommend for those who are listening, Isuzu.com, please go check it out. And for those leaders, please share it with your communities. Now, Samir, one of the questions I ask every guest who comes on the podcast is, what does an imperfect leader mean to them? And so how does that term resonate with you?
Well, frankly, I'm a big fan of it because I think no one is perfect. I am by far from perfect. And I think, you know, the pursuit of both leadership, but just life itself, right? And America and every nation, every country is the pursuit of becoming more perfect, right? And inching towards an aspiration. And so that really, I think, hits home. I think every day is a learning opportunity. We're all trying to become the best version of ourselves. And the day we stop trying to do that is the day we have a problem. And so I'm a big fan of that framework.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being. And I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of An Imperfect Leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder. And after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class. And the kid next to him, like, sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. And my guest is Samir Goyal, and he is the co-founder and co-CEO of Isuzu, the leading financial technology company helping individuals save money and build credit. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they've made, and then we discuss it. So Samir, what happened?
Peter, I have a number of decisions that I could talk about that went poorly, but I think a general theme for me is really working with people, especially other leaders, right, that may report into me, but are really organizational leaders, and providing the right type of feedback early and often and frequently. And in terms of what happened, I think earlier in our journey, you know, I had this misconception that my job as sort of an inclusive or thoughtful leader was almost to adapt to other people, right? And sort of perpetually give people the benefit of the doubt. And when they would do things that I thought were maybe subpar or that bothered me or a communication style that didn't work, I would sort of just not share that feedback and instead hold it in. And I almost thought that was like the justified or the right thing to do in the spirit of sort of being a thoughtful and sort of inclusive leader. And frankly, that was a disservice all around. And what it really led to was people being surprised when all this sort of like frustration and I would say buildup of decisions and actions and sort of operating models that didn't work for me sort of came up in a performance review or a sort of random conversation. And frankly, no one likes to be surprised, right? And people also want to know where they stand. And so I wasn't necessarily sharing positive feedback. I was just not sharing negative feedback. And that creates this sort of vacuum of uncertainty, which is frankly, I think the worst for people. Because I think everyone wants to know where they stand. And when they don't, it just sort of allows your mind to run off with it.
So let me put it this way, because I think many of those who listen to the podcast are either aspiring or they are new superintendents who are trying to sort of navigate this new position that they're in or considering, you know, a move. And so many of these leaders, they will inherit teams. And they're trying to understand and get a beat of the system without making too many quick changes. And they also are trying to get to know the people on their team. And it may be sort of this impulse to wait before they give feedback, right? Whether it be appreciative feedback, right? Looking at what's going well and saying, how can we get more of it? And maybe motivational feedback where they are sort of rah-rahing and giving positive praise. They're maybe reluctant to give constructive feedback because it will be interpreted as destructive feedback and then sort of poisons a well and makes a and creates, you know, additional issues for them as they move for change and positive change for children. And so if I understand correctly, it sounds like as you were, you know, co-leading with Wimimo and you were entering this, you know, and building your team, and as you're hiring people, that what may have gotten overlooked is the how essential it is to give people feedback pretty quickly, you know, early on, as opposed to waiting for these sort of interim moments where you check in and then you're giving some potentially some constructive feedback when they've only been receiving sort of praise and then are very confused. Am I capturing that?
You nailed it, Peter. I think there's two risks, right? One is sort of you only give positive feedback and then people are blindsided when there's negative feedback and they feel like it was unfair or unjust because it's the first time they're hearing about it. And then that leads to a lot more sort of emotional turmoil. The other risk is that you just don't give feedback at all and people don't know where they sit. And then that uncertainty creates a lot of insecurity and emotions and people, that's when you see people start playing more politics. That's when you see people sort of start to hedge and have one foot out the door, right? And so I think both of those are challenging, but to your point, there's always a risk with giving feedback that someone could take it poorly. But I tend to think of compassionate leadership, which is something one of our mentors, Jeff Weiner, talks about a lot, as sort of transparency, right? And that doesn't mean that you deliver feedback like a jerk and just yell at people. What it means is that you sort of talk through what you're feeling in a transparent and honest way, where it's like, hey, look, I might not have all the context here, but you did this, you took this action, and here's how I perceived it. And that's not how I'd want to operate our team. Let's talk about what happened there and how I'd expect you to kind of operate moving forward, right? And that's sort of acknowledging that you might not have all the context. It's sort of, this is how I interpreted that, right? And then you can kind of work through some of those challenging conversations in a more compassionate manner versus just like, hey, you did this, it sucked, never do it again. That can certainly be destructive. And on the flip side, just bottling it up then leads to a much more sort of blow up performance review than just sort of having an honest conversation and being transparent.
Tell me about where those conversations happen, because you alluded to how destructive it can be to do it sort of as a drive-by, right? Giving someone feedback and then moving on. And I can certainly speak to that, having been in a leadership position with, you know, I think we had 3,000 employees. And I remember stopping by a school and asking someone to walk with me. And I gave them some feedback that didn't go over well. And then I got in my car and left, which was the worst thing you could possibly do, right? So as an imperfect leader, and in the spirit of being vulnerable, I share that as don't do that. And I'm listening to you, right? I'm listening to you talk about how important it is to say, I may not know all the information, but this is how it made me feel, and I want to talk about it. And so I'm curious how you have sort of shifted from where you started with your mentor and with the coaching that you're getting. And what does that sort of look like? Does that, is that a planned meeting? This is in someone's office. Where does it happen? I wonder if you could just kind of like unpack that a little bit more.
Well, what I love about that example, Peter, is that it's actually very literally a drive-by, which is which I thought you were talking about more metaphorically, but that was literally a
no, I was parked. I was parked. So. I had my hazards on.
I enjoyed that. So I think honestly, what I think it is it all comes down to managing expectations. And so if you have a team member or even a team that you inherit, and you set expectations that, hey, I'm not going to provide you with feedback very often. When you get feedback, it's very jarring, right? And this is something that we actually talked about with our leadership coach as well, Jeff, is sort of like people are really used to you being a rah-rah cheerleader, right? They're very used to you always being sort of looking at the glass, you know, half full, never looking at the glass half empty. And so then when you sort of can't take it anymore and you just deliver really constructive, but frankly, it comes across as much harsher than it would have if you would just set the right expectation from day one. And so that almost then turns into a cultural change. And so with leaders that we've worked with for a longer time, it's almost like, hey, let's sort of like spoon feed you on this process of taking on more constructive feedback. And frankly, that need also changes as the organization evolves, right? When it's you and like five people against the world, everyone just needs positive feedback, because frankly, everything's sort of such an uphill battle that there is no space for just like, this sucked, right? But as you grow and as you have an organization and you need to set the right sort of standards for excellence in what you're looking for, feedback becomes also more important to become constructive and compassionate. And so for those leaders, it's almost like a journey. But what's really shifted is how we operate with new leaders, right? Which is from day one, it's, hey, let's set the right expectations. We're going to be transparent with you. This is how we operate. We much prefer to have direct, transparent, upfront conversations. If we're doing something that doesn't work for you, call it out as well and let's talk about it. And never take a honest or candid conversation as sort of personal, right? We just find it to be more productive and actually welcome dialogue and frankly, even disagreement, right? Like, we can have an opinion on something you did and you might have a different opinion, and we talk through it and we get to a kind of shared place, right? And a little bit of that is also, you know, I used to think that my job was to adapt to everyone that works with me. And that's frankly not my job, right? It's also part of it is sort of like, hey, here are my working standards. And if you want to be successful in sort of communicating with me, here are some of my needs. And you, what are your needs? And how can I kind of be thoughtful about those as well? But it can't be only one directional where it's like, hey, Peter, if we work together, Peter, what are all of your needs? And I have no needs. And so I'm just going to adapt to whatever you do, well, right?
Then you're looking in the mirror and you don't even know who you are anymore. You're really speaking to what you've learned about relationships. And I'm wondering, you know, what has this taught you about relationships?
I think it's a great question. I think the secret to any relationship is intentionality. Like, don't just let things happen, right? People are way more in control of things than they allow themselves to be. I listened to a really interesting sort of talk recently that was sort of on being a player versus a victim. And it's very easy, right, to say, this person did X, this happened, rather than here's what I can control, right? And I think building a great relationship takes intentionality, it takes time, it takes forethought. You know, I have two great relationships in my life. One is with my work husband, Wamimo, and the other is with my wife, Julie. And they both actually take very similar things, right? Which is sort of, here's a little bit of intentionality in terms of understanding your needs, where you're at, being thoughtful, building trust. And a relationship is sort of consistently doing what you say you're going to do over a long period of time. That's how you build a trusting, healthy relationship. If I say I'm going to do something and I don't do it, that's like, that erodes a relationship, right? And so, you know, that was sort of a rambling answer to get to the point of intentionality, right? What do I want from this relationship? What are the expectations I'm going to set? How much time am I going to invest in this relationship? And people have more control over those things than they give themselves credit for.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, when you start with five and then you grow exponentially, which is, I know, is what Azuzu has done, because the need has been great. The response has been so impressive. So I ask this question sort of like, in the end, what was something that was good that came out of the situation? And I'm curious, as you have learned from waiting before giving feedback and then now providing feedback, you know, much earlier in the process, and again, engaging in dialogue, discussion, disagreement, arriving at a shared image of what success looks like. It sounds like these are the pieces that really speak to what has now been a really improved situation in terms of where you started and where you are. So what would you say is something that was good that has come out of this situation?
I mean, Peter, you definitely covered some good things that came out of it, but I think it's ultimately a much more effective team. You know, every team that you build, you want it to be greater than the sum of its parts. And I think in the past, that wasn't necessarily the case, right? We kind of had a number of, if you think about a football team, right? And you have 5 or 10 all-stars, but they can't play as a team, then you're still going to lose the Super Bowl, right? And so I think what we have now is a team, right? Rather than a series of really talented individuals who are all sort of operating in their own silos. And so creating this shared definition of success and being transparent with that and not treating, you know, not adapting everyone's leadership style, but really creating a unified sense of here's who we are, here's what we want to accomplish, here's how we welcome, not necessarily conflict for the sake of conflict, but we welcome constructive conflict for the sake of being better as a team, as a group, as a unit.
Well, that's important to note, right? I mean, that's important to note. It's like when we, you know, we talk about that sort of compelling purpose. What are we trying to create together? And then we can have that sort of dialogue, discussion, and debate as long as we're all sort of moving towards that as the goal, as opposed to just disagreeing for the sake of disagreeing. Or
One of the things I say to just about anyone who starts now is like, your job is not to be right. Your job is to contribute, right? And I think one of my pet peeves has become people who really think that their job is just to prove that they're the smartest person in the room, which is actually like not necessarily useful, right? Like, you wouldn't be in your seat if you smart and talented and capable. The point is, how do we contribute to something bigger than ourselves?
And if it weren't so passive aggressive, I'd say, like, you should give little ribbons. You're the smartest in the room today. Okay, everybody, smartest in the room. We got it. All right, let's get back to work.
And the last thing I'll say on this topic is, I actually think being able to be constructive and have conversations where you might not be on the same page actually leads to a better relationship, because there's not anything unsaid. And I'm sure, like, it doesn't have to be a work relationship, but you asked about relationships. In any relationship, if you're having a conversation with someone and there's, like, something that's unsaid, that's a weight on the relationship, right? You're watching what you're saying, you're watching what you're thinking, you're kind of not really being honest, and it drags the relationship down, whether you're talking about a marriage, whether you're talking about a friendship, whether you're talking about a coworker. And so, you know, I think the beauty is that when you say what's on your mind, it also leads to a more healthy relationship where you feel like there's a greater sense of trust and sort of ability to just have a conversation without sort of walking on eggshells.
Do you find that you've had to think differently about when you share your thoughts on a particular topic? Sometimes leaders will say, they enter the room and the moment they say something, then the rest of the team sort of assumes that's where we're going. And so their thought is, the moment that the leader, you know, whoever the founder or whoever the department head is, they say, I think, you know, I'm thinking that we should do it this way. Then everyone goes, oh, I guess that's what we're doing. And so have you had to be mindful and thoughtful about when you begin to contribute your own thoughts on a particular topic?
Yes. And I go back to intentionality. So one of the adages that I've learned, and I think it might be one that is practiced at Amazon, which is your home state, but it's like often like the most senior person speaks last, so that people share their unfiltered perspective, because the minute that you say something, people are just sort of conform to when brownie points or whatever. The other thing that I do is I'm very, very clear on like what's a mandate or a decision versus here's an opinion, here's something to think about, here's the consideration. And the place that I do this the most now is actually talent. So I get pinged people's resumes all the time, and I'll forward it and I'll literally say, here's a resume. If you think it's a good fit, feel free to reach out. And then I will clearly state no expectations or obligations on my end to reach out to this person, right? Because I want to make it very clear. It's not like, don't hire this person, then say, oh, I thought you wanted us to hire this person, that's why we hired it. No, that's your choice, your decision. Let me just make that very clear, because it's not always sort of clear. And so sometimes it's easy to sort of just qualify some of this stuff a little bit intentionally, and that'll make a difference.
Yeah, it's curious how one has to be explicit in that way, because there are some unwritten rules based on one's title. Even though, you know, you want to be coworkers and you see each other as peers, unfortunately, sometimes just the hierarchy of the organization confers some sort of unspoken, you know, expectation that you did not intend. Last question. What advice would you give to an aspiring leader?
You know, Peter, it's a good question. And there's probably a few things I could share. But if I were to pick my top, one would be this: just be caught trying, right? And sort of in the name of this podcast, Fred, an imperfect leader, like, we're all in the pursuit of trying. And I think as long as you leave 110% out there, that's enough, right? And I actually learned that at the conference, the Clinton Global Initiative, where Wemo and I met. And one of the speakers, maybe even the former president, had said, you know, be caught trying. And that really always stuck with us. You know, is this idea where we're not going to be perfect. We're not going to get it right every single day. But if you get back up there and you try, that's what half of being a leader is about, right? And so I'd say, don't talk yourself out of it. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have good days. You're going to have great days. You're going to have horrible days, but be caught trying.
My guest was Sameer Goyal, the co-founder and co-CEO of Isuzu, the leading financial technology company, really helping individuals save money and build credit. And Sameer, I want to thank you so much for joining the podcast. So many of us in leadership are really, truthfully, we're looking for ways to disrupt the system in a positive way. And you and Wemimo, you are doing that. Isuzu is doing just that. And what it's doing is making the system accessible for all, not just for some. So thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Peter. Always love having a conversation with you. Appreciate you having me on.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a woodprint-inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader. Leadership in after action. Imperfect leaders, are you facing challenges filling open speech language pathologist positions within your district? It's kind of a silly question because I know you are. Empath Speech understands the critical need for qualified professionals in your schools. They recognize that communication lies at the heart of academic success, and that's why they're dedicated to helping you bridge the gap by offering expert therapists and innovative telehealth solutions. Don't let open positions hinder your students' success. Partner with Empath Speech today and ensure every child in your district has access to the speech therapy they deserve. Empath Speech, empathspeech.com. Empowering students, empowering schools.